Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to You Come First with me, Megan Barton Hanson. You may know me from the 2018 series of Love Island.
Since before Love Island, I've always had a passion for women's rights and interests. So I'm here to tell you everything you need to know when it comes to putting yourself first, whether that be in a relationship, in the bedroom, your career, or your mental health. I've called in friends from around the world for an intimate, unfiltered conversation that will change your life forever. The reason I started this podcast is because since I've used my platform to speak so openly, I've had so many of you contact me on social media and even stop me in the street asking me to do a podcast. So now we really can get down and dirty and discuss the most important things that just aren't talked about enough. Expect lots of laughter, a few tears, and for the penny to finally drop as we discuss the most taboo and private topics, helping you focus on the fact that you come first.
Today I have a really special guest with me, Timmy Shotira. We met at an event recently, and once I got to know more about Timmy's story, I knew I had to get her in and talk to her about her unique and inspiring life so far. And she's only in her 20s. A fellow Essex native, Timmy was the first in her family to go to Cambridge University, and being black and queer, she definitely faced some challenges.
Timmy, thank you so much for coming on to talk with me today. You're so accomplished for someone who is so young. But can you tell us a bit about your backstory? I know you're from Brentwood, near me, a fellow Essex girl.
Yeah, Essex girls.
What was it like growing up in Essex 20 years ago?
Oh my God, when you say 20 years ago, it makes me feel so old. Oh my God. Growing up in Essex, it was an interesting experience because I'd say that, like, nobody was ever, like, really mean to me when I was younger. I wouldn't say I was, like, bullied or, like, I had a really awful time, but I definitely was aware that I was different because I was, like, the only black girl in my friendship group or, like, one of maybe three black girls in my year. And so I just remember growing up always feeling quite insecure about looking different and having a different background to all of my friends. And I always thought that no matter how close I got with people in school, there'd always be like a gap in knowledge or understanding of each other. I think I just had that for like the whole time growing up. And I just, like, looking back on it, I definitely wasn't very secure in myself. I just thought that I was like weird, and because I was different, that meant I was less than all of my friends and stuff. I think I also just wished I was from London.
I don't know. Yeah.
Because I knew like a lot of black people were living in London. A lot of my family were in, like, lived in more diverse areas, and I just really envied that. I wish I just was raised somewhere that was more diverse. But then also looking back on it, I do actually love Essex now. Like, I think I love my friends from there. It is a great place. But growing up, I just always felt really weird about it.
Yeah, I was the same. Like, growing up, I just felt like Essex is so, like, small and, like, narrow-minded, and I don't know, there was so much going on in London and it was so much more diverse and just interesting.
Yeah.
But I think as you get older, you kind of appreciate, like, the little things about where you grew up. I was always ashamed to say I was from Essex, like, especially Southend-on-Sea, because it's, like, deemed as, like, oh, a trashy, like, seaside town. I kind of was like, oh, I'm from, like, Essex, and then wouldn't really want to tell them, like, oh, from Southend.
That was me, because I'm from Brentwood, and it was like Brentwood was Towie.
Yeah.
So I was just like, yeah, I'm from Essex. I wouldn't really say. And I also feel like it might be different now, but I feel like growing up, everyone was very similar in Essex. And if you didn't fit that mold, you could like really feel it.
100%. And had you always wanted to go to a university like Cambridge?
So I actually had never even thought about it or considered it until I'd gotten my results in year 12. Because I think it's like a bit different now, because you know how the education system's always changing.
Mm.
I think so when I was in school, you had like AS levels. So you'd do exams when you were in your first year of sixth form or college, and then you'd get your results, and that was like half of the A levels, and then you do the second half in your final year of school.
Mm.
So I ended up doing way better than I thought I would do, than I thought I was gonna do. Amazing. In my first year. So I kind of saw my results, and my dad was, I have the memory of like my dad and my sister looking at it being like, you could apply to Cambridge for that. Being like, wait, what? No, that was never on my radar. And like, I think I just, again, it was like a self-confidence thing. Like, I'd never thought about it, just because I just never ever saw myself as being the kind of person who'd like go to Cambridge. I think and again, it's probably changing a bit now with like the Stormzy scholarship and stuff, but I do think that growing up, Cambridge was kind of for the poshos, or like the people that like went to the, had like, were really rich, had money, went to the really good schools, or like, I don't know, just like had a certain way about them, like
I know what you mean. Horse
riding and stuff. Yeah, it
was like never went really, to boarding like, school, when like from birth, yeah. It was just like destined that they're gonna be super academic and just
like their
go.
Parents went and their grandparents went. It was like, it was just always seen as that kind of place. So when I had the results, I still was like, yeah, I've got the results, but like there's so much more to going to Cambridge than just having the grades. And then even my school was saying a similar thing. They were like, they were kind of discouraging me from going.
No way.
Yeah, my history teacher literally took me away at the end of one lesson and was like, oh, I've heard you're thinking of applying to Cambridge. And I was like, yeah, I'm thinking about it. My parents are kind of pushing me, but like, I don't know. And she was like, yeah, you know, like Cambridge brings in a certain type of person, like, and she listed off the like head boy, like the last head boys that were in my school, who were all like posh people that like were in like the army, that did that, the army school thing, like, I don't know, I can't even explain it, like, well, like grade 8 in like the clarinet or whatever. And she listed their names and was like, yeah, you're not really like them, are you? Like,
she needs to be sacked.
I know, and looking back on it, I should have complained, but because I was so insecure, I was like, you know what, like, she's right. Like, yeah, I'm not a Cambridge person. What's the point? And luckily, my dad, I'm so glad that I had my dad, because I got home crying to him being like, I'm not doing it. Like, my school key doesn't think I'm going to get in. And he was like, who gives a shit what your school's saying? Like, if you think you can do it, you can do it. Like, if it wasn't for my dad, I wouldn't have applied. I would have listened to my teacher and been like, yeah, I'm not doing it.
Oh my God, thank God for your dad. And thank God that you're so strong, because I know that's such a vulnerable age. For like, for me, I was so insecure at that age. If someone said one thing, I would take it to heart. So you're so good.
Especially like a teacher.
Yeah.
Like, someone that you kind of look up to and you think like just knows more than you. Like, for someone, I just know, like, yeah, I should have gotten them sacked.
Oh my God, please go back, find out if she's still working, and I'm going to join you. We need to start a petition. Get rid of
protest,
this.
Yeah.
So what subject did you study, and how did you choose a subject, like when you decided and got into Cambridge?
So I did this course, it's a very convoluted name, it's called Human, Social and Political Sciences, which basically is everything ranging from like politics, sociology to anthropology. So when I was young and naive, I really wanted to be an MP. So I just wanted to do a politics degree so I could become like a member of parliament and like change the world.
I love
that dream. It fizzled out very quickly because I realised that MPs are just, I just don't like politics. I'm not a politics person. I haven't got the heart for it or the stomach for it yet. So I applied for that course, and I don't want to get too into the like Cambridge way of doing things, because this isn't a Cambridge podcast, but the way a lot of courses work in Cambridge is that they're really broad, so they have these broad names, but you can specialise in it. So the name of the degree is Human, Social and Political Sciences, but you can go in and kind of pick a track under that umbrella name to do. So I went in thinking, okay, I'm going to do politics. But then after my first year, I was like, I don't like politics. So I decided that I wanted to do sociology. Just because I think... I love sociology. I'm a massive sociology nerd. It's just about learning how people work and interact and looking at things like social justice and inequality. And those things really matter a lot. Like, they mean a lot to me. So, yeah, I decided to do sociology. And that was kind of what I specialised in. Like, that's what we call it. It's kind of like in America where you have a major. So my specialism was sociology, but the degree was human, social and political sciences. I hope that's a good enough explanation.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Okay.
No, I get it. So I done sociology at GCSE level, and it was like the only GCSE that I cared about. So I can imagine, and as difficult as it must have been so interesting. And sounds way more really interesting good. Than politics.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, another thing that put me off applying to Cambridge was that, like, it lives up to the stereotype of being just very academic and, like, traditional and, like, just focusing on classical stuff. So politics, I thought I'd be learning about, like, I don't know, like, terrorism or, like... climate change, just like pressing political issues, but it'd be like looking at Plato and like reading his texts, or like just looking at really old white men from like the olden days.
So boring and outdated.
Just like looking at their texts and like analyzing it, and I just thought it was so dry. So which is why I moved to sociology.
Such a good choice. So what was your overall experience at Cambridge like, would you say?
So
was it what you expected? Was it better? Was it worse?
This is the thing, because I had like no idea of what the uni was like. I didn't really have many expectations for it, and I think I kind of thought I'd have like a normal uni experience, and it just really isn't like any other uni in the UK. I look back on it and I'm like, Timmy, you are so naive. Why couldn't you just do a quick little Google search? Or like, just give yourself like 15 minutes before we walked in to see what you're about to expect. I think I thought my experience at uni would just be like all of my friends or like people that I knew that had gone to uni. I kind of thought I'd like have that freshers experience, like be living in halls and like living in a house my other years. I'd meet a lot of people who were like me. But yeah, the Cambridge stereotype of it being full of like very well off people that are quite posh is true. I got there and I was like, okay, I thought I was like a minority in Essex. This is different. And weirdly enough, I almost feel like being raised in Essex as like a black girl kind of prepared me in a way. I felt like by then I was a bit stronger, and I think I was feeling a lot more secure in myself because I'd actually gotten into Cambridge, so I was like, I can actually do it. But then I think when I was at Cambridge, I don't want to say too much or like bait people out. I think I made a lot of mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes, and like people that I became friends with. So I think because in Essex I was so used to like feeling like I was stuck out or like not really belonging, I really wanted to almost like reinvent myself in uni. So I was like, okay, when I get to uni I'm gonna like be part of the cool group or like make friends with like people that I see as being cool. But my idea of what cool was very much like rooted in just like just rooted in immaturity. I think I saw the cool people was like those that like went out every night, that like thought they were like better than everyone in a way. Like, I don't know, because I don't know how to explain it. But I then realized after my first year that like firstly, there's no such thing as like the cool group. Yeah. Just be friends with whoever you want to be friends with. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, all of those things just don't matter. Like, people that being popular and those things are just, yeah, it's just like, oh my God, I feel like I'm stumbling over my words.
No, I completely get it.
Not that important. And I think that's one big thing that I really learned in uni, because I spent so much of my time in Essex wanting to be cool and wanting to fit in. And then uni taught me that, like, I've been chasing this thing that I don't actually need. I actually don't need to be seen as cool by other people. I don't need to be in, like, the quote-unquote popular group or, like, do all these things. I can just be myself and the right people will come to me.
Yeah. Did you learn that quite early on in your experience? Like, it makes perfect sense if you felt like an outsider or you didn't fit in Essex, and then you're going into this other environment where you're going to feel even, like, more of a minority. It makes sense to, like, get in there with the popular cool kids, as people say. But did you feel like once you was in with a popular group, I don't know how long you was there for, but did you think, actually, these aren't the people for me, it's not what I want, I'm just going to focus on studying and people that I actually have a vibe with? Or did you have that same friendship group the whole time?
I think I did realise quite early on, just because there were certain things that, like, made me feel, like, really uncomfortable. So, you know how I mentioned that when I was in Essex, my friends were actually all really, really lovely. I just felt like an outsider. I think when I got to Cambridge, I realised that I actually kind of had a good thing going on in Essex. Like, my friends were very considerate of me, but in Cambridge, the people that I thought were cool were actually quite ignorant. Mm. So they would say some things to me, like, about my race or my culture, or, like, about the fact that I was from a working class background. That just made me feel really uncomfortable and just felt quite insensitive. And that was, like, in my first year. So I realised that quite early on. But then, I'm going to be completely honest with you, I think there was still, like, a small part of me that was like, oh, I can't fully distance myself from this group just in case, like, they actually might be, like, worth it in the end. Like, maybe I'm making a mistake here. So I did stay friends with them for the whole time in uni, but I definitely did, like, distance myself throughout the 3 years I was there. And, like, now that I've graduated, I'd say that I'm actually really close friends with those people that I met, like, in my first year, that I was thinking, oh, actually, I think they're the people that I should be friends with. They're now my best friends. Yeah. So I guess it has worked out. And to be honest, I think I'm glad that I went on this journey, because I now feel a lot more sure of myself.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I feel like every young person does that. They just want to fit in. They just want to feel like, okay, if I'm in that popular group, life's going to be easier. And, like, kids and young people can be evil. Like, I got bullied at school, like, yes. So it's best to just stick.
Wait, no way, did you get bullied in school?
Yeah, badly.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry about that.
I think everyone gets it a bit. It's just kids to be honest, evil.
Yeah, because yeah, even I got bullied in school. Like, I think, yeah, you're right, everyone does in some way, don't they? Kids are so shit.
That's why I think we need, like, more mental health support for, like, at schools, because the only reason people bully is because they're, like, their own insecurities and projecting, but
exactly.
That's a whole different podcast. But do you think universities today are doing enough to combat institutional racism, would you say, or not really?
Good question, Megan. That's a very good question. So what I think, and this is something that I realised when I was in Cambridge, firstly, I think a lot of the UK, like, discourse and conversation is focuses on Oxbridge. It doesn't really look at other unis. So that everyone's talking about, like, oh, there's not enough black people in Oxbridge, what's going on? But there aren't enough black people in a lot of the good unis in the country. Mm. That's, like, a whole other conversation. From my experience of going to, like, an elite university, I think a lot is done to bring people in. So they do a lot to try and diversify the talent pool, like people being admitted into the university. But then once you're actually there, they kind of just leave you alone. There's, like, not really much support once you're actually in the university. So what I found was that I got in, and, like, I think every year that has gotten into Cambridge from my year has become more diverse. But what I found was that I got in And I was like, okay, I'm here. There aren't really many people that are like me here. But then all of the other students that had gotten in that came from the more like traditional Cambridge backgrounds had like no knowledge or understanding of people like me. So I kind of spent a lot of my time at uni like educating people, kind of telling them like, no, that's not what you're meant to say, that's not how you should think. And now looking back on it, I'm like, that was not my job. No. My job, like, I should have gone there to study and have fun. Not to try and like be the anti-racist advocate. And like, I felt a lot of pressure from other people, and I also put pressure on myself to kind of be that voice of reason. And yeah, I think looking back on it, I think university should have like actual institutions or bodies and groups in place to try and educate their own students and faculty members and like lecturers on how to, I don't know, just how to like be decent people. It shouldn't be on the job of the students to be doing that themselves.
Yeah, exactly. When you're there trying to, like you say, make friends, learn yourself, that should not be your responsibility whatsoever. It's mad. How did you find, because I feel like, from what I've seen, I've only done one talk at Cambridge Uni, and I felt like the pressure and everyone talking about their studies and their results, and it is just a different world. Like when I walked in it's like Hogwarts. I was like, oh my God. So how did you find?
Because you spoke at the union, didn't you?
I was so nervous. I felt so out of place. I was like, oh my God, I'm just from Southend. And I felt so like, not judged, but I just felt like they were like looking down at me and like, really intrigued to see like what I'd say because I'm from like a working class background. But there was actually so lovely. It was fine. But I think it's just like built up in my head. But it was just like a different world, like Hogwarts or something, like I said. And the pressure seemed intense on like everyone's studying and stuff. So how did you find the pressure?
Yeah, like you're right. It was very Hogwartsy. And I think this is another thing that I didn't really think would happen, which doesn't happen at other unis, but it's such a big thing in Cambridge. Like, people's degrees are, like, their whole lives, and it's, like, their whole identity. So you'd go to a party, and people would just be talking about their lectures and stuff, and I'm like, guys, like, we're not in the library. Like, it's actually okay to not talk about your degree. And I remember when being at Cambridge that I did feel pressure to kind of make, like, sociology, for example, my whole brand, and, like, do all the reading under the sun about like sociological issues and like come out with all these zingers and just be that person, because that's just what everyone else was doing. But again, like looking back, I'm like, your degree is like your degree and you study it, but you're a whole person outside of your degree. Like it's actually, it shouldn't define your whole life, because there's so much more to life than studies. But it's really hard when you're in that bubble to remember that.
That is,
it's only when you go back into the real world and you're like, firstly, like in the where I'm working now, most people don't even have degrees, and people that do, like, they don't even talk about it. It's just like a thing that they did years ago. Whereas I think in Cambridge, you're made to believe that like this degree that you do is gonna have like a imprint or marking on the rest of your life. So you have to like work really hard and like get a first and like 90% across the board, otherwise you failed and you wasted your time in Cambridge, when it just isn't true.
Yeah, I feel like there's so much pressure. In hindsight, you saying that about that's all people spoke about. When I went for my talk, there was no talk about like what people's like weekend plans were or like anything personal. It was pure studying, and I wasn't even studying or knew what they was talking about.
Why are you seeing that? Like, you're not even a student. Like, it's so silly.
It's a different world. But when you look back, did you have good times as well?
Yeah, I definitely did. I haven't even spoken about like anything good about Cambridge. Like, I actually did have a really good time there, and my best friends now, most of them are actually from uni. Like, it took me a while to find people like me, but I definitely have. And I think it makes our connections even stronger, because like me, they felt out of place in Cambridge, so they can relate with me in that sense. And I think like there's just certain aspects of going to Oxbridge that you'll never experience again. So like we had these things called formals, which would three or four course dinners that happened every week that you could like choose to go to, and you'd wear like the black like Harry Potter gown, and you'd like sit at a candlelit dinner, and like you'd have a three course meal, and like, you'd get really drunk, and they were just great. Or like we had these thing called balls where they'd get a whole Cambridge college and just like turn it into like this big like fairground or like party that would go from like 9 p.m. to like 6 in the morning.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was, and it would be like free food, drink, musical acts, fairground rides. So like there were some things like that that were really special to the experience that I will always like remember and cherish. And I definitely have met such amazing people, like even when I was talking about like the popular group, wanting to fit in with them. There were some people that I met in that group that are still like my best friends today, that I absolutely love.
It does sound so, like something I can't even relate to, but yeah, when they're telling me about these dinners, when they're like, wore these special gowns, it's like, oh my God, it's like going back in time. I just wanted to attend, not to study, but just to have a week and just pretend, just write, make up notes in my book and just sit there around all these posh people.
Sit there in a lecture, like, yeah, like it is like, just, even at the time, it felt like very surreal. I just wasn't used to it. And thinking about it now, I'm like, that was so weird. And it just felt really normal, but it's a really weird thing that we did.
It is so weird. I want to go back and just walk around again. It's just like nothing I've ever experienced.
Yeah, but it's like a whole little bubble, isn't it?
So weird. But from your time in Cambridge, you'd done your sociology and now you're an established journalist. So can you tell us a little bit about how you found your way into this career?
Yeah. God, I feel like every story I say with you just starts with me being really insecure. But I have loved writing and books like since I was a child. So when I was in primary school, I was always writing short stories and poems, and like that was just what I loved, and I was reading all the time. But the older I got, the more I thought that it wasn't very cool to like have that as a hobby. Like no one was really saying that, like, yeah, I like to read as a hobby. And I was like, I want boys to like me, I want to make friends, so I'm just gonna like ditch that part of my life. So I spent my teen years not really doing much of that, and my plan was to always, I don't know, I think I put, looking back on it, I put a lot of pressure on, like, me rebranding myself in uni, because when I was in school, I said that when I get to uni, I'll start writing again. But then I went to Cambridge, and like I said before, I was very insecure and just didn't really believe in myself. So I did none of that in Cambridge, because I was like, everyone's so much smarter than me, like, why the fuck would anyone want to read my writing?
Oh.
But then when I graduated, I was looking back at my time at uni, and that was the one thing that I almost regretted, like putting myself back and thinking, just assuming that I wasn't good enough, so, and not doing anything as a result. So I thought that now that I'm away from that Cambridge bubble and I'm like back in the real world, I'll just start writing again and writing about things that matter to me. So at first I kind of used my sociology degree to talk about current issues and things that I just saw happening in the world and my opinions on them. And yeah, I got like, so one thing that happens in the journalism world is you like write pitches. So you kind of write like a summary to publications being like, I can write about this because of X, Y, Z. And it's one of the worst things about being a journalist, in my opinion, because you get rejection after rejection after rejection. So I remember when I first graduated, I would have like a Sunday afternoon where I just like send out loads of pitches and hear back from like none of them, or get rejected from all of them. And then after like a few weeks of doing that, I got a pitch accepted from this publication called Black Ballad, and I wrote for them. And I also would write for my friend's publication for free a few times, because he had like, I'd say like a cultural magazine / website thing where there'd be sections on like fashion, culture, music, art. So I interviewed a few musicians on his website for free. And it was through that I was like, oh, I actually really like interviewing people. That's something that I find really interesting. And I also love music as well, because I DJed a bit in uni and stuff. So I was like, okay, I like to write. I like music. I like interviewing people. Maybe that can like be the thing that I do. So yeah, I just started like doing that. And as I started doing it more, more editors of publications started to know who I was and would ask me to do things. So it kind of became like a bit of a snowball effect where I just found myself being asked regularly to like interview people that I really loved and rated. And I was like, I can't believe this is my life.
Amazing.
And now it's great because, yeah, now like I'm in a space where I feel like I'm doing what I've always wanted to do when I was a kid that I just kind of got a bit too embarrassed about. So I feel like I'm making my inner child very happy.
I love that for you. Empowered and using all your best skills you've like learned along the way. I love that.
Yeah.
Out of all the people you've interviewed, who would you say has been your favourite? Because you've interviewed some amazing people in the music industry, haven't you? Let's do some name dropping, please.
Oh, God. Okay, so I guess, like, I'll do the ones that people will definitely think will know. Like, so I interviewed Dua Lipa earlier this year because she collaborated with Puma to create this shoe. And, yeah, I interviewed her for that. That was just, like, so surreal because that was something that I remember I got a DM from an editor being like, are you up for like interviewing this like really big artist? And I just was like, this is spam. I was gonna like just block it, but I was like, you know what, let me entertain this. And I found out it was Dua Lipa, so I was like, thank God I did not block this.
Oh my God, could you imagine?
I would actually cried if that was the case. Another artist that I have loved since I was a kid that I interviewed in January was Jasmine Sullivan. She's an R&B singer and just has like the best voice ever.
Oh my god, what's like her really legend. Famous song about the smashing of the windows?
Bust Your Windows.
I love that one.
Yep. When I was like younger in school, I would listen to that on the bus, like, yep.
Oh my god, yeah. My first ever breakup, I think all I did was kiss this guy, but I was like blasting that out of my Nokia.
I love that. You kissed him and you're like, you bust your window.
Literally, pure psycho from year seven.
No, that was me. Like, literally in year seven, like, there'd be a boy that I fancied. He never even knew that I fancied him. And I saw him, I'd see him like hug a girl and I'd be like, fuck you, I'm gonna bust your window. So yeah, I think they were like the biggest people that just felt really surreal. I interviewed Bree Runway last year.
Amazing.
Before she like became like as big as she is now. She's just amazing. Like, her personality is just, it just shines through. Like, she's great. Who else can I name drop? Why is my mind going blank? I think they're like the people that will like be known by the most, I think.
They're huge.
There's a lot of people that I like nerd out over, but I'm not sure you'll know them.
No, they're huge names. Do you ever get nervous before you interview them? Or not really?
I say in the beginning I did. But then after you do a few, you kind of realise they're all just people. Yeah. I think I'm not really one to get a starstruck anymore. And I actually think that's a good thing. Like, I think I'm glad that I've gotten to that point because one thing that I've noticed is that, like, people that are in the spotlight almost hate to feel like they're celebrities or, like, that they're different. They kind of want to be just spoken to like a normal person.
Yeah.
So I'd say with the Dua Lipa one, I was definitely nervous because I was like, okay, this is actually a big deal. But I think for everyone else, and the thing is with her, there were like eight people on the call.
Oh my so God, like, that's pressure.
Yeah. So I was like, I can't say anything wrong here. But I think for everyone else, I was like, nah, these are just, I had to remind myself, these are just people talking about their music. Like, then they're not like, they don't want to be seen as anything special. They're just here to talk about what makes their music great and why they love music so much. So, yeah.
That's so true. Much of your writing showcases Black British talent, and you recently announced your participation in Black Joy as a co-editor and contributor. Can you tell us a bit more about this and when will it be released?
Yes. So, yeah, I think one thing that's always mattered to me is just putting, like, Black people out there and, like, platforming them. Because I think just everything I've been speaking about to you, like, today just kind of has made me realise that I do care a lot about just making Black people feel seen mm-hmm. and giving them a voice. Because I think growing up, I never really felt like I had that personally. Yeah. And as someone who's a fan of music, I think in the UK, there weren't really like a lot of Black women, for example, in the music scene. And thankfully, that is changing now. I'm really happy that's changing. So yeah, when I started writing, that was something that I was just really passionate about. So I think most of the people that I've interviewed have been like Black women, apart from a few like Dua Lipa. and yeah, and then Black Joy is an anthology that I co-edited with Charlie Brinkhurst-Cuffe. She's a senior editor in the New York Times, and she was previously the editor-in-chief of this publication called Gaudem, which is a publication for women and non-binary people of colour.
Yeah, and I think I follow them on Instagram, actually.
Yeah, they're great. They're honestly amazing. Like, Charlie is just, like, a trailblazer. She's...
And you've written for them as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. So I actually knew her professionally before. So what happened was, last year, Penguin approached Charlie in wake of Black Lives Matter, the resurgence of them, and was like, we want to do an anthology about being Black and British. And Charlie had the idea of making it about Black joy, because like, as you know, like, last year was really hard for Black people across the globe. Mm-hmm. And I think she just wanted to create something that focused on Blackness, but the joyful aspects and the parts that make us happy.
Yeah.
Which I think was like just so important to do. So then at the end of last year, she opened up like applications to have a co-editor. So that would be someone who edits 5 of the essays, writes their own essay, and like just kind of like oversees the creation of the anthology alongside her. So I applied for it, interviewed for it, somehow got it.
Somehow? Because you're an absolute boss bitch. That's how.
Oh, no, stop it. So yeah, like, I got it, and it's been absolutely amazing. I think this episode will come out when the anthology is already out. So it comes out September 2nd, which is this Thursday. So it would have been out for a while by the time this episode is out. So I'm really excited. We have a launch event on Thursday. It's going to be really fun. We've got some amazing contributors in there. It's like Leanne from Little Mix, wow. Minya Chihuahua, the comedian. Diane Abbott is in it. Shantae Joseph, Jason Okundaye, like those Love Island commentators, which we all love. Bukki Bakare from the film Rocks. She recently won a BAFTA. So yeah, it's like a lot of really cool people are on it. And I just feel so happy to like be a part of it and to have my name on the cover. Because again, like I said, this has been a dream of mine to have my name on a book in a bookstore. Like, when I was younger, this was what I was like dreaming of every day. So it's crazy that's actually happening, and it's something that means so much to me. Yeah, and I just hope everyone likes it.
Oh, congratulations, I'm so happy for you. I can literally just see your face beaming. It's so yeah, nice, it's just to so see nice someone to happy.
Oh, thanks.
So when you look back at your impressive career, what advice would you give to young people attempting to break into the world of journalism?
So I'd say, don't do what I did and put it off for years on end thinking that you're not good enough. Because one thing that I've realised since being a journalist is that there are a lot of mediocre writers out there. And like, it's actually okay. Like, because I think for me, I always thought that I had to be the best of the best of the best to ever do anything. And because I never felt like I was the best, I wouldn't really do much. And I've realised just that way of thinking isn't right at all. Like, if you enjoy something, just do it. Like, who cares if you're shit or if you're not that great? Like, and if you carry on doing something enough, you're just going to get better at it. Like, the way I was writing when I first started is so different to how I write now. Mm. But my love for writing and journalism has made me a better journalist and writer. So if the passion is there, just go for it. Like, please don't be disheartened if you see people that you think are doing really well and then therefore convince yourself to not do it because you're not at their level. Because one thing that I've realised in every industry is that most people don't think they're good enough. Everyone has that like imposter syndrome to a certain extent, or like everyone gets moments where they think that they're not good enough. But if you just remind yourself that you are good enough and that you're great and that you're amazing and you push past it, then you'll exceed and you'll do like amazingly well. And I guess in terms of like more concrete advice that isn't like all airy fairy in that, if you're just starting out, don't really know where to go, I'd recommend like having like a blog or like something where you can just put your thoughts down and like write and get into good practice. Because I think, and I had this as well, like a lot of journalists and writers think that if they're not like, if they haven't got like a weekly column in The Guardian or something, then they're just not doing well or they're failing. But I think everyone's voice matters and everyone's voice counts. So does it really matter where you're writing, if that's a personal blog or like a really small publication? As long as you're putting in that practice and you're trying to hone in your skills and become a better journalist, that's all that matters. So like when I was in school, for example, I had this WordPress blog where I'd like write once a month about shit going on around me. And I think that was really helpful. Like I wrote for free for my friend's publication for a bit, like just things like that, just to make you feel a bit more confident. If you're struggling with confidence, I think always works out.
Yeah, definitely. And no one's perfect when they start out. It is just that exactly. If you've got that passion, it does shine through, even though you're like, that's kind of airy-fairy advice. I think it's like facts. Like, even with this podcast, I was petrified. I put it off for so long because I can't host anything. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm dyslexic. How am I going to read my questions? What am I going to do? I'm going to stutter over my words. But I think if you've got the passion and you're genuinely interested in like what you're writing about or the person you're interviewing, it comes across. So you don't have to be exactly. Like the best of the best.
Exactly. And you're like doing an amazing job, by the way. You're like, you're a great host.
Oh,
I think we're all just so quick to convince ourselves not to do things.
Right. And what you said about comparison as well is such a big yeah. thing in like my industry, and to hear that you feel the same in your industry, I think we all struggle with that.
Yeah. And I just always think like if everyone thought that way, like there wouldn't be anything out there. Like it's just, it just takes that plunge and just being like, you know what, fuck it, I can do it. And like 9 times out of 10, like it actually ends up being fine. And even if it doesn't work out, like you've at least learned something. Like there have been so many things that I've done, for example, that haven't worked out, that, or like, as I was saying, like when I make pitches and they get rejected, like rejection is normal. I'm not going to act like I've had a very smooth and easy journey.
Mm.
But you learn something from every positive and negative experience, right? So it's just a case of kind of reminding yourself that and being a bit fearless, I'd say.
So true. Such good advice. I'm so sad. I've literally got to go, but I want to ask you one more question because I could speak to you all day. We have to meet up after this podcast. I'm like obsessed with you.
I've always been obsessed with you, so this is great.
Oh, thank you. Do you have any goals for the future? What are your goals for the future?
Yeah, I actually do. Gosh, again, it stems from another insecurity that I have. But the reason why I'm always rooting back to things that made me insecure is that I'm in my 20s. And one thing that I really want to define my 20s is trying my best to overcome all the things that made me feel insecure and shit about myself as a teenager. So like my race, being a black woman, my sexuality. I actually didn't even talk about this, but I came out as bi like last year, and that's been a really big thing for me. Like me having a writing career, I used to feel really insecure about that. So I'm just trying to like face all of these fears and insecurities head on, I guess. And like I said before, like speak to my inner child, like all these things that were such a big part of me that I kind of allowed myself to feel shame about, I'm trying to kind of reclaim. So another part of that is fiction writing. So when I was younger, I just loved writing short stories. Like I had loads of ideas for novels and stuff. But when I got older, I didn't think that my fiction writing or creative writing was that good. I always thought that sounded a bit dumb and I didn't sound like an intellectual or like any of that. And I think going to uni really intensified that, because everyone just sounds so smart and well-read. And as a girl from Essex that speaks really casually, I've just never ever been that kind of person. But I think now that I've done the Black Joy stuff, and I know that I can write, like, I definitely can. So I think my next goal is to tackle the fear that I have surrounding my creative writing. And just reminding myself that, yeah, I can write a book if I want to. Like, I can start planning that and writing that, or, like, write a short story. Like, that's the next goal that I have for myself.
Oh, my God. This genuinely makes me so happy that you're, like, working on all these, like, insecurities that you had. Because I have a therapist that I see weekly, and she was like, all these insecurities are from, like, the inner child. Like, you've got to take care of the inner child. And that is exactly what you're doing.
Oh, my God. I literally learned it through therapy as well. Like, that's been my main takeaway from therapy, like, just speaking to my inner child. Like, it's really sad how when you grow up, you, I feel like I've mentioned this a lot to all my friends and stuff, but when you grow up, you, all those things that you loved as a kid, you're kind of made to believe embarrassing. You kind of go into yourself a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to kind of undo, like, all those years of me going into myself and feeling like I'm not good enough, because I'm the fucking shit. Like, I am good enough. I can actually do it. Like,
you so are. I love yeah. this. So I'm literally getting calls left, right and center, but I can't not ask you about coming out. How was that experience for you coming out? Was it last year, did you say?
Yeah, so it was like November, December time last year, so it's still very recent and fresh. Yeah, it was so daunting, I'm not gonna lie. I came out to my parents and, like, my family, and it's even weird to talk about now, because, like, it still doesn't really feel that real. But I feel like that whole time was kind of the start of my new life, in a way. I feel like since doing that, I feel so much more confident in myself. I feel like I'm the real me.
Yeah.
Because it's been a part of me that I've been, like, ignoring, I'd say. Like, I just kind of thought that with time, I'd, like, the gay would go away. Like, I'd stop feeling it. But the older I got, the more I was like, no, this is just who I am. I just live in my truth. And, yeah, like you were saying about the inner child and therapy really helped me with that, because I was like, this is such a big thing that is making me feel shit about myself. And I think if I just live in my truth, like, so many things will just feel a lot better. And I'm not gonna lie to you, like, there has been some fallout with it, with, like, family members not really agreeing with me and feeling disappointed in me. But I think despite all of that, I don't regret it. I think I should never regret living in my truth.
No, so, and being your most authentic self. And you must feel like a weight's been lifted.
Definitely. It's just so nice. And, like, I'm in a relationship and I have a girlfriend at the moment. And just, like, being able to, like, know that I can put her on my social media and, like, not be thinking, be like, oh my God, are people going to think that, like, we're together? Or, like, be able to hold her hand in public and just small things like that, which used to fill me with so much shame. I'm just like, no, I can do it now. Like, I can actually do it now.
Oh my God. This has been so uplifting. I love talking to God. You. Thanks. You are living your best life. Oh, it's been so lovely. So lovely chatting to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. If you did, please rate 5 stars and leave a review. And be sure to subscribe so you get next week's episode as soon as it lands. And remember, for the best experience, make sure you listen on the Entel app.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.